Good morning and welcome to the East Tennessee Report, a public affairs program of the Journal Broadcast Group. My name is Frank Murphy. This morning, we are delighted to have as our guests Dr. William Bass and John Jefferson, known as the writing team of Jefferson Bass, the authors of the new novel Flesh and Bone, set at the Body Farm here at the University of Tennessee. Of course, Dr. Bass, we know as the curator of the anthropology research facility at the University of Tennessee, the Body Farm. Welcome back, Dr. Bass.
Thank you, Frank. It's good to be back.
And we're delighted that you've got John Jefferson with you this time around. John, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
John is the co-author of Flesh and Bone and the previous Body Farm novel, also Carved in Bone. Dr. Bass, we know your credentials for a minute, but let's start focus on John for just a second. And how did you meet Dr. Bass and also co-author the nonfiction book, Death's Acre? How did that collaboration come into being?
I was doing television documentaries for some years, and I called Dr. Bass out of the blue. I said, you know, I've always been really interested in science. I used to be a science writer at Oak Ridge National Laboratory. And I thought it would be really interesting to do a documentary about the research that they do out at the Body Farm. I'd seen a couple of things that had been done about the Body Farm, but they always focused mostly just on sort of the sensationalism of showing bodies on TV. They didn't really talk about the research, which I thought was the important part.
That show I've seen every once in a while repeated on National Geographic Channel. Is that you?
Exactly.
Okay, that's
right.
The one you did. All right.
Right,
okay.
Right. Yeah, one of the shows, I did two shows. One was called Biography of a Corpse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I guess I thought of that because I was doing shows for A&E, and they're one of their flagship series on A&E is Biography.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, at the Body Farm, your story really starts, you know, when you're dead.
Yeah.
You know, at the moment of death, and, you know, and then your life as a corpse goes on from there until they clean off your bones. And so we actually followed a corpse all the way through the decomposition process and the research project that he was being used for. Anyway, and that's how Dr. Bass and I met.
All right, so Dr. Bass, when you got that first phone call from John, your reaction was, okay, sure, you know, that you wanted that kind of publicity for the Body Farm, or it was good science?
Yes, I've always been happy to share the research that goes on at the Body Farm. If you don't, people think you're doing something illegal or something like that, and I've never been that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to ask you first, Dr. Bass, what was John's first reaction when he saw the Body Farm for the first time, when he first stepped through the gate?
Well, he held up very well. He was very much like our graduate students. I mean, you know, he kind of had an idea what it was going to be like, and it didn't disturb him at all.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and the thing is, I mean, particularly when you're in the company of Dr. Bass, you know, you get so caught up in the science and what you can learn from it that you forget to be uncomfortable.
Right.
It's too fascinating to...
It's nature taking its course is really what it is.
Yeah.
You're talking
but
about
it's
the life
nature
cycles of...
taking its course and telling you things that you didn't know before,
mm-hmm.
You know, and using that to help figure out, you know, what happened in these real world crimes. And so all of that is just so fascinating that, you know, I mean, that's all you can focus on or think about.
John Jefferson and Dr. William Bass, the team of Jefferson Bass, then made that switch from nonfiction books, the book Death's Acre that came out 3-4 years ago?
Yeah, 2003.
Okay. And that was a really nonfiction account of some of the cases that you, Dr. Bass, worked at, going back to the famous case of that made you want to start the Body Farm in the first place. We had the 100-year-old body who...
The Curl Shaw case.
Yeah,
that's right.
Who looked more fresh than he should have been.
That's true.
More recent than he should have been. But you made the turn at some point along the way to say, hey, why don't we fictionalize this? Why did you decide to do that? And maybe that's John for John.
Yeah, well, that was John.
There's a little bit bigger market for fiction than for nonfiction. Mm-hmm. You know, we really liked working together on the first book, the nonfiction book. You know,
but I thought maybe it's in a way it kind of limited you because you had to say certain cases that were too sensitive. You had to say, well, there was a case about a guy. And, you know, as you're reading, you're thinking, okay, but when you're able to fictionalize it, you can then give it a full backstory.
Well, you can
backstory.
Have some fun. You can have
yeah.
some fun with the characters and the story. You know, you can make things really dramatic. I mean, a lot of Dr. Bass's cases are very dramatic, and we're actually working on another nonfiction book right now.
Oh, well, you know, I'm going to expect another Body Farm novel next year. Now, you set the pace
right.
of now two in consecutive
yeah.
No, know,
our
years.
Publisher expects another one next year, too.
All right. How long does it take to write one?
Years. No.
Well, I mean, because you've got, there's a lot, the book is so rich in detail that I imagine that the research behind it takes quite a bit of time.
I tell you, going to that cockfight in Cock County took me, you know, several days just to figure out how to get in.
And a year ago when we met with Dr. Bass, I asked him if he was the one who went to the cockfight and threw up and in the first book, carved in bone. He said, no, that was John. It was actually you.
That was me. I didn't throw up at the cockfight. I threw up somewhere else. I put together two things, the Copenhagen, getting sick from trying Copenhagen and going to the cockfight. Those were two separate adventures I had, but I put them together because I thought they fit.
It sounds like as I'm reading the Body Farm novels that this character of Dr. Bill Brockton, whom I imagine to look and sound like Dr. Bill Bass, really has a lot of John Jefferson in him.
He has some of both. The kissing the student part in the first book, that wasn't a Bill Bass part. That was more sort of John Jefferson fantasy.
My wife saw my excitement in finishing Flesh and Bone, the new book, and she wanted to read it. And I told her I wanted her to go back and read Carved in Bone first because there are several characters that carry through. And it's helpful, I think, to be introduced to them in the first book. And maybe that's part of the reason, if I can say, that I like the second book better is because I already knew who the people were and I didn't have to go through that exposition. I was ready to just dive right into the story.
Right.
John says, well, let's do some books in with a fictional character. And I said, you know, I really like nonfiction better, but I will have to say that John had convinced me that doing fiction is really interesting. I mean, that's because you can... And it's very difficult in this series to know what is fiction and what is not, because we use Art Bohannon, who is a real individual, and we use his real research.
Mm-hmm. And he's the fingerprint expert for Knoxville Police Department, who we probably take for granted because he's from Knoxville, but he's famous nationwide, worldwide for his research.
He is. He's an individual that designed and developed the super glue method of finding fingerprints.
Which I first read about in a Patricia Cornwell book years ago.
Yes. This is where you heat up super glue and you blow it with a fan over a body, and the super glue will attach itself to the oils and the fingerprints, and you can see the fingerprint.
And describe the other process that is described very well in the new Body Farm novel that Art uses to restore or somehow. What do you even describe that when he takes the skin of a corpse that you found, your character finds on the ground?
Exactly. What we've tried to do is a fictional story. However, the science in there is accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And what we would like to do is to, being a teacher, we still want to teach. We're teaching a little bit different than what you do in a classroom or something like that. And in the first one, John had a scenario of a body in a cave. And I asked John, okay, is it a wet cave or dry cave? Because it would make a difference in how the body decays. So in this one, we have a case of an individual who is tied to a tree and decays, and that decay is different from lying on the ground in a horizontal position.
Right. The top was not as decayed as the bottom, which
made it hard to... That's right. What happens is you see the maggots come out and they drop off on the ground, so this retards the decay, amount of decay that you normally see in a body lying on the ground.
Because the maggots are chewing the soft tissue. But if they can't get to it because they keep falling off it's going
to
remain.
They will try to get back on the body, but they don't get much higher up than about the knee, something like that.
Uh-huh.
And
So the actual experiment that's described in the beginning of the new book, did you perform that same a close experiment to that at the real body farm?
Yes. And all of these will start with a research project. All the five books we first signed to do three books, and then HarperCollins came back and asked if we would do two more.
No kidding. So, I would have signed you up for more than that if I were them.
Too bad you're not there.
But they will each have some section of forensic anthropology in them.
Right.
And this one has an individual who is decayed away, and it's called degloving. What happens is the epidermal layer of the skin sloughs off the hand, and that is the layer that has the fingerprints on it.
So when you retrieve the decayed body, you were unable to determine who he was because he had no fingerprints.
That's correct. And the fingerprints are at the scene of where the body decayed.
Mm-hmm.
And so Dr. Brockton knows this, and he goes back to the scene, gets down on his hands and knees.
He's looking for what looks like a leaf.
Looking for a leaf, that's right. And what you do, you bring this back, and you put it in warm water overnight.
What else did you put in it? Like some dishwashing liquid?
Well, he likes to put fabric softener.
A fabric softener. Okay.
He puts a little fabric
Downy. Yeah.
Downy.
Yeah, I remember going for the endorsement deal from Downy.
Oh, good luck with that. So I remember hearing the word Biz in there too, which I thought was a detergent, but that's probably for
well, that's cleaning, for cleaning off the bone.
That's a different process. Different.
The other endorsement deal.
Just get Procter & Gamble on the phone. You're safe.
Yeah. Those satanic rumors they've been fighting, those will seem minor once they get hooked up with us.
So you've taken the sloughed off skin and put it in some fabric softener.
You leave it overnight, and then the next morning when you come in, it's reconstituted itself, in other words. And what you do is you put on rubber gloves and you slide this guy's fingers over your finger, and you can print them that way.
Now, Art Bohannon from KPD does this. Dr. Bass, have you or John tried this technique yourselves?
I've done that with Art, yes.
What about you, John? Do you get a chance to do any of this hands-on science? Or you just...
Well, I get to do some hands-on things, but mostly when my hands are on things, it's holding bones steady while Dr. Bass cuts through them with an autopsy saw to get a cross-section for a DNA sample.
Okay, well, it still sounds
amazing. I'm the unskilled labor.
Well, because the character of Art Bohannon is a real person... And his character is based on his real personality, I guess, right?
That's correct.
And Dr. Brockton is based closely on Dr. Bass. It makes me wonder, you know, as we read through the book, who the other characters are based on or if they're entirely fictional. There's one character in particular who turns up in both books, Dr. Jess Carter, who I kept thinking, I wonder if this is Patricia Cornwell. You know, if it's based on her or, you know, of course, maybe not.
No. No, but I will tell you, it's... We have a female forensic pathologist here in Knoxville named Sandra Elkins.
Okay.
And she is from Chattanooga.
Oh, all
and
right.
She has thought that we were writing about her. It really is not
but
her.
But we're not.
Yeah.
Well, as you get into it and you realize that this has to be a fictional character because, you know, your personality is developed in such a fashion that, you know, okay, well, you know, this can't be based on any one real person. Like, you wonder about the defense attorney who turns up in a couple of the different books, if he's based in part on some real characters around town.
There might be a flamboyant criminal defense attorney who helped inspire that character.
There's the medical examiner in Knoxville who you think, you know, was he based on somebody real elsewhere in the United States? You know, there was a situation, I guess, in the first book where Dr. Brock, here I am doing it now, Dr. Brockton starts by investigating a corpse and putting a knife into his back to see if the medical examiner correctly diagnosed this person's death. And turns out the medical examiner was way off base, and Dr. Brockton has to testify to that. Are there medical examiners in this country who are that inept as the character in your book?
No comment.
Well, I'm saying, I'm not saying in this county, I'm saying in this country, right. Anywhere in the U.S.
Yes, there are. I mean, there are people who are even worse off than some of the characters in our book, really.
Oh, wow. All right, that's amazing to me.
I mean, people are people. Any profession that you sample is a microcosm. They're going to be people who are really smart and great at it, and they're going to be people who are not so great.
But I guess because in East Tennessee, we have Dr. Bass, we have Art Bohannon, and the people you work with, they're all elevated to really a higher level of their work is a higher quality than, you know, forensically speaking, than elsewhere. We're spoiled by you guys. So when you read about someone who seems inept, it seems like, well, that can't be true. We've got the best of the best right here.
Well, yeah, well, you would hope so. But John says that there are people who don't do a very good job of doing what they do.
Mm-hmm. All right. We're talking with Dr. William Bass and John Jefferson, the writing team of Jefferson Bass. Their newest Body Farm novel is called Flesh and Bone, and it's in stores everywhere. In fact, we've got some signings coming up that I want to make sure that we do mention. Autograph signings all throughout East Tennessee for your chance to go meet the authors and get your copy of the book signed. There's a fascinating subplot in the new book, Flesh and Bone, where you use your teaching techniques, I guess, and it's a way you've taught us as we read the book about the whole creationism versus evolution debate that still rages on all these years after the Scopes monkey trial. And John, I know in your acknowledgments at the end of the book, you mentioned some of the research you did into the actual Scopes monkey trial. Let's touch on that for a minute and just the whole evolution subplot in general. You know, one of the things you used in the book is something that you and I have discussed in our previous interviews, Dr. Bass, is the fact that I'm missing some teeth up here. I'm missing my lateral incisors. And you said that was an evolutionary step, I guess. I don't know. If, I'm not going to say advance. I'm not going to say advancement, but let's say.
No, no. You are the new improved model, Frank.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
But let's. Can you recap that a little bit and how it has it affected you in your teaching in real life?
Well, I've, you know, when I came along and was taught about evolution, it was always kind of theoretical and so forth. I thought, you know, there's nothing better than the human body to show that evolution occurs. And you take a class of course, I always thought 300 in the introductory class, and you get people in there that cover, you know, millions of years of change in the human body.
Mm-hmm.
We normally have 32 teeth this with third molars, and of course, we're losing our third molars.
Meaning that we're extracting them, or just we're being born without them?
Both.
Okay.
Let me put it this way, that the mouth is getting smaller as we go through time.
Okay. Could a reason for that be that our food is so processed we don't have to work as hard to chew it?
No. Or? You need to go back a long ways. Let's go back to when you have your pre-primate insectivores. These are the people who are really, I mean, you're 60 million years ago now.
Talking about little shrew type.
Little shrew type critter. I read that in the book. okay. This is when the dinosaurs were dominant on the earth. And these mammals are coming along and they live in the trees.
Yeah.
And they live on the ground first and they're sniffing out their food. So they have 44 teeth. They have a long snout out in front of them. Now the dinosaurs come along. And you don't want to be a little shrew-like critter on the ground.
No,
when
kidding.
A dinosaur steps on you, there isn't anything left of you.
You don't evolve from that point forward. You're done.
That's right. So somebody said, you know, we've got to go into the trees.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's always, oh, I don't want to go into trees. You know, there's no, you know, change is something that people don't like. And so.
And shrews.
And shrews.
Yeah.
but the shrews decide they'll go do this. Now, you go to the trees and you have this long snout that you're used to sniffing out your bugs on the ground. It's difficult to. You have your eyes on the side of your head because you have your nose sticking out there so far. You're smelling the bug, but it doesn't help much to smell the bug when the bug has already flown by.
Mm-hmm. You have to be able to see it better.
That's right. And then you begin to develop. There's a premium then on those individuals with a shorter snout or nose or mouth. And those with better vision.
Sort of the difference between predator and prey. You know, the prey generally has their eyes on the side of their head to keep alert for predators, and the predators are focused on the front so they can catch the prey.
Exactly. Okay.
Yeah.
Exactly. This is exactly what you've said it in. Go ahead, John.
I'll come on the tour with you guys if you need any help.
There we go.
I think you've got it under control. I don't think you need me.
But anyway, what happens then, there's this premium on the reduction of the length of the mouth.
Mm-hmm.
We started with 44 teeth. We're now down to 32. And we are on our way down to 28. And many of your audience are going to be, they will have had impacted third molars.
Right.
An absolute excellent example of evolution, because you're trying to crowd 32 teeth into a mouth that will hold only 28.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is there's not enough room for the teeth. Now, there are many people who never have third molars. And in the next group, which are really far advanced, are those that are losing their lateral incisors, and that's you.
That's
you
me,
see, so,
and my daughter too.
Okay, yeah, all yeah. right. Well, she's picked up the genes for that, and
although my orthodontist withdrew or extracted the teeth underneath, so I just have that many less teeth in my head. My daughter's orthodontist did the opposite, where they created a space and put fake lateral incisors in her mouth.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And that seems to be the new thing. They want everyone to look the same.
They're like a new car that has a retro look.
Yeah. I tried to talk them out of it, but that's what they wanted to do.
That is interesting.
So someday, I mean, I'm not going to necessarily donate my daughter right to science just yet, but that's something you might be researching years from now. You know, this trend of you know, people altering their teeth with these implants and other things to try and look like they've got the bigger mouths.
You put in a bridge, and that bridge has the enamel part of the tooth. There's no root there.
Exactly, yeah. It's a metal screw that's going to hold it in place when she gets it done.
And another thing they're doing research on is, you know, as the skeletal collection at the university grows, you know, they're taking measurements, you know, on all these skeletons that are coming in. I mean, more and more every year now. to the Body Farmer, donated, and they're putting all of these measurements into the data bank, and so they can watch over time, you know, how the cranial dimensions change, you know, how the, you know, to accommodate, you know, brain size, you know, how.
Well, I thought of your book when I realized that both my kids are much taller than I am.
Right.
Because you talk about over the course of the years that, but then again, my father was taller than I am too, so it didn't, that doesn't really help out.
Yeah. It's funny though, the, you know, back in the period when the, you know, the Dutch Master Cigars box,
right.
You know, those guys, the Dutch back when they, you know, founded New York and so mm-hmm. on, they were kind of little short people. Now the Dutch are the tallest people on Earth
really?
On the average. So, you know, I mean, you can see over a few hundred years. In various mm-hmm. populations, you can see some changes.
You're hearing John Jefferson and Dr. William Bass, the writing team of Jefferson Bass, author of the new book, Flesh and Bone. Coming up in a few minutes, I'll tell you where they'll be this week. You can meet them and get your book signed. You bring up a point, though, about studying Dutch bones and bones from elsewhere in the world. You know, the Body Farm is sort of unique, certainly in the United States, in that you can skeletonize people here under these weather and climate conditions. And we've talked a little bit about this last year. Shouldn't there be body farms in every corner of this country or every corner of the world?
Well, there should. I've been tried for years to get my colleagues to put in body farms, say, in Arizona or Texas or something mm-hmm. like that. There's an attempt to do some of this now, but they're having their share of problems with this.
Well, how do you study Dutch bones, then, or Dutch stature? John just mentioned a moment ago, where do those bodies come from? That to be studied?
Well,
live people? I guess you can measure live people.
Yes,
for height.
You can measure the live people, and then with the expansion of culture and cities and so forth, many prehistoric cemeteries are being dug up.
Oh, okay.
And those bodies are now, those skeletons are being measured, so we get a pretty good idea of what people were like. I mean, the tombstones will tell you when they died, and so you'll know when at what period they're in.
Mm-hmm. As more and more people become familiar with the forensic data bank at the University of Tennessee and use this forensic software that they developed at UT, you know, more people from around the world are sending in measurements, you know, to this data mm-hmm. bank. So there's this network of people out there, of forensic anthropologists out there that are adding to this data all the time.
There's two things I want to make sure we touch on before our time flies by. The Big Bopper case is in the news, and Dr. Bass has been retained by Big Bopper Jr. to dig up the Big Bopper. Why is that?
Why is that? Okay. The Big Bopper was
We had a hit, Chantilly Lace. He was in a plane Lace, crash with Richie Valens.
Plane crash, okay.
And Buddy Holly in 19-something.
1959.
Around this time of year, early February.
That's right. And was buried in a cemetery near Beaumont, Texas. And in those days, that cemetery did not allow above-ground monuments. So you have only a horizontal monument.
Okay.
As time goes by,
they're easier to mow.
Well, that's true.
That's why they do that, yeah.
As time goes by, the cemetery decides it will add a section with above-ground monuments, and the Big Bopper's wife died only about 2 or 3 years ago, and she's buried in the part of the cemetery in which you have above-ground monuments.
So Big Bopper Jr. wants to put mom and dad together.
That's right.
Of course. All right.
Now, the Texas Historical Commission wants to put up a statue or a monument for the Big Bopper.
After all these years, he's still so well-known, it makes sense.
That's right. Yeah. And so they were going to dig him up anyway. Now, in any death like that of a person, I think as time goes by, the family begins to have questions about certain things. I'm not quite sure what the family was told when he died.
Yeah, one of the things that made it into the press was that the Big Bopper's body may have been found at a different distance from the plane wreckage as the other musicians.
He's the furthest from the plane wreckage. Now, not too far. I mean, 20, 30 yards, something like that.
But that's
they wonder whether he survived the crash and was trying to go for help.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they didn't give them that information in those days. And he sees an opportunity now when they go move his dad anyway.
Yeah.
And I think, right. I mean, if I was in the same position, I would do the same thing.
And you'd be able to tell because, of course, your adage, your mantra about bodies.
That's right.
Is that the flesh forgets, but that bone remembers.
That's right.
So if he's got, you know, if his legs are terribly fractured, he's probably not trying to go for help. I mean, mm-hmm. he can't walk. So.
Yeah. So that would explain that he was thrown by the wreckage. And
right.
probably could also tell from the bones if he likely died on impact or,
yes,
or
if the skull is crushed badly,
right.
then you know, well, I mean, he was unconscious and he couldn't have gone for help. But.
So you may not know positively for sure, but you can certainly rule some things out.
That's right.
And then, of course, one of the real pressing questions that the Bopper Jr. has is, you know, there was a gun on board the plane, and there's some questions about whether this gun had been fired and how many times, and there are rumors that there was a bullet hole in the pilot's seat. And so, you know, the most unlikely scenario, mm-hmm. but the most intriguing is, could there be a bullet in the body of the Big Bopper?
Can you fictionalize this for the next Body Farm novel?
Well, we'll put this in the next nonfiction.
Oh, okay. So. It's true. You don't need to. This is, in this case, truth is stranger than fiction. We're talking with John Jefferson and Dr. Bill Bass. The book, Flesh and Bone, is dedicated to the memory of Officer Ben Bohannon. And just recently, you had a fundraising event at the University of Tennessee for the Benjamin Bohannon Memorial Scholarship Fund. Tell us about that fund, won't you?
Well, Art Bohannon, his
father, mentioned earlier,
is a character in the book. And Art had two children, a boy and a girl, and his only son was killed. He was going home one night from work and was hit by a trailer truck on I-40 down about where Broadway comes into I-40. And we thought, I mean, since Art is such a good friend of both of us, we thought that one of the things that we ought to do is to support the family and, you know, help the university by, they have created a scholarship for Ben Bohannon in the UT Police Department. And what we're doing is we contributed money from that book signing yesterday to that cause.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, Dr. Bass is, of course, well entrenched in the university, you know, and a legend there. And I know they appreciate everything you do for them, the notoriety that you bring. You're right up there with Pat Summitt and Phil Fulmer, don't you think?
Well,
John, you would probably agree.
Yeah. Well, actually, they did a study. Was it the marketing people at UT who did a study?
That's right, yes.
The two things that UT is best known for are UT football and the Body Farm.
Oh, fantastic.
Those are the top two things.
If you're a fan of Dr. Bass and John Jefferson, you can get your copy of Flesh and Bone and get it signed. There are several signings coming up this week, including tomorrow at Books A Million in Oak Ridge, mm-hmm. and then on Wednesday at Hastings. Books and Music in Merrillville, then at Books A Million in Johnson City on Thursday, and at the Kroger on Kingston Pike on Friday. This information you can find through links at their website, jeffersonbass.com, and there's other events later in February, too. I see you're headed off to Texas, and you've been to Arizona and all these other places as well. We very much appreciate your taking some time to spend with us this morning.
It's great to be here.
Yes, it is.
And you read the book very closely. You get an A+.
Well, I did my homework. I had the weekend to it, and I dove right in on Friday and plowed through it as best I could and finished it in time for the interview, obviously. My wife saw my excitement from reading the book, and I've told her she's got to go back and read the first one first for the characters who continue through.
That's great.
There's a couple of things that happen in the book that I don't want to give away. In fact, I probably should mention this, that, you know, as you find out more about the book, don't read the reviews necessarily all the way through. I guess what I'm worried about is that there's events that happen in the book that are best left to be uncovered by the reader as you get to them.
There's a big plot twist that, you know, that we hope people won't be spoiled for people.
Right.
And one of the reviews on either Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com does give that away. So, you know, if
right, I'm glad I didn't know it, you know, because I had to stop what I was doing and think, oh my gosh, you know, this book is a great book, and I'm just blown away by the developments that occur. So I don't even want to, other than say that there's something there, I don't want to ruin it for you. I'm overhyping it, but just read the book, enjoy the book, and especially the local Knoxville references are amazing. The detail you put into from getting off the interstate at Paper Mill Drive to just every little thing. Big Ed's Pizza in Oak Ridge is in there.
I've consumed my weight in Big Ed's Pizza over the years.
I'm trying to think of some of the other things that are mentioned in there. The Butcher Brothers are in there.
Track Bistro.
Yes, the By the Tracks Bistro plays a part in the book. There's the Orangery is mentioned. There's
The Fellini Kroger on
that's
Broadway.
That's the one. That's exactly the one I was trying to think of. All these things that I've learned about.
I used to shop at the Fellini Kroger. Mm-hmm. So, there's a lot.
Are you the guy who timed his shopping visits to coincide with the release of the Social Security checks?
I didn't actually time my visits, but I did notice, a couple of times I was in there and there was this long line of really interesting looking people at the customer service counter. And I thought, what's that about? And so I asked, when the Social Security checks arrive in the mail, there's this huge rush of business at the check cashing counter and some really interesting folks there.
Again, John Jefferson, Dr. William Bass, we appreciate your time. This is the East Tennessee Report, a public affairs program of the Journal Broadcast Group. My name is Frank Murphy. We'll talk to you again next Sunday.